What Will Christians Do About Slavery? The fifth talk in a series on Christianity in America was presented by Tim McIntosh on April 24, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So last week we talked about the beginning of the 18th century, and there were a couple of challenges. I'm organizing this class in terms of challenges that faced American Christians during the development of the nation. And the two challenges that we talked about last week were, first, can Christianity convert the common man? The beginning of the 18th century is the beginning of the era of the common man. Andrew Jackson is elected president. He is unlike, let's say, Thomas Jefferson or John Adams. He doesn't come from this great family background full of prestige and money. He's just a great general. He's just a, you know, and he talks with a twang, and he's one of us. And the people love him, elect him president in the early part of the 1800s. And at the same time, the Second Great Awakening kind of erupts across the United States, and lots of conversions take place. The conversions are not happening just among the genteel people of the North who are well-read and well-spoken and also come from money. They are Kentucky frontiersmen. And the Kentucky frontiersmen end up, during the Second Great Awakening, both converting and going through strange experiences that are still debated to this day, whether or not these are like real signs of real spiritual conversion. They're barking like dogs. They are doing dances and head jerks and things like this. So the answer to the first challenge was, yes, Christianity can appeal to and convert the common man. The second challenge is Christianity progressive? So at this time, during the Second Great Awakening, there's a very strong impulse to reform society, mainly to reform society of the chief sin of the day was alcohol. And so lots and lots of reform efforts made toward suppressing alcohol because it's seen as kind of a root of all sorts of rambunctiousness and violence and things like this. And we also saw near the end of this lecture that several kind of end times communities pop up. And these end times communities are kind of reflect the temper of the time, which is we see that Jesus is probably coming back very soon, and he's going to come back when society is kind of shipshape, when we've kind of like ironed out our moral problems. And so the Oneida community and other communities like this put a real strong emphasis on moral purity in their own peculiar way. And so the answer to that challenge is yes. Yes, Christianity is progressive. Now, that is going to be that kind of progressive attitude is going to meet like the challenge that probably the most significant challenge that has ever struck the United States, which is the Civil War. And the challenge for today is, what are Christians going to do about slavery? That's the first challenge. The second two things that I want to talk about are less challenges, they're more questions. How did American slaves from Africa view Christianity? That's the second question. And third question, oh no, I can't remember what it is. Oh, how do we come back together after the Civil War? What's going to happen? This is not just something that we can just, say, no, that was no big deal. American Civil War, no big deal. This is the American Civil War. There were more casualties in the American Civil War than there were in World War I and World War II combined. And I think it was something like 8% of all white males between 18 and 43 died. I mean, that's a devastating number. Devastating number. Okay. So how is the United States going to come back together after the Civil War? We begin today in a place called Newburyport, Massachusetts. Do you guys remember what happened in Newburyport? Newburyport has popped up twice already in my lectures. Do you remember what happened in Newburyport? Someone famous was buried there. George Whitefield was buried there. And then something happened just before the onset of the Revolutionary War in Newburyport. Do you remember what happened there? They dug him up. They exhumed the body of George Whitefield. A little militia group dug him up, and they took trinkets of George Whitefield with them into the Revolutionary War to fight the British. And we're there again today. There's a man named William Lloyd Garrison, who is born in Newburyport, Massachusetts. He's born in 1815. As a young boy, he sells homemade lemonade and candy and delivers wood to help support his family. And then at 18, he gets a great job. He's working for the Newburyport Herald. If you're a younger person, it's a newspaper, and a newspaper is kind of a large folding pulp paper current events report. I really was telling my writing students the other day, I was like, you know, you could write an op-ed for a newspaper. And they looked at me sideways like, I don't know what an op-ed is. And I'm, you know, I know what a newspaper is, but no one really reads those things anymore. Garrison began writing articles as a young man for the Newburyport Herald, and many of them he wrote under a pseudonym, Aristides, who was an Athenian statesman and a general known as the Just. Garrison met, during this time, two Quaker abolitionists, John Greenleaf Whittier and Benjamin Lundy, and both of them were deeply influential on Garrison. By age 25, Garrison had joined the abolitionist movement full force. He began writing for a Quaker newspaper called The Genius of Universal Emancipation in Baltimore, Maryland. This newspaper did not print what you would call mild editorials making kind suggestions about public policy. In it, Garrison wrote editorials in one editorial in which he called the American Constitution, so long as it accepted slavery, a sham and a pact with the devil. He printed a blacklist in the Universal Emancipation, and this blacklist was not only highly incendiary, it named names. So the blacklist was basically a column that was devoted to printing short reports of the, quote, barbarities of slavery, kidnappings, whippings, murders. In one blacklist, he reported that a shipper from Newburyport, Massachusetts, named Francis Todd, was involved in the slave trade, named his name, involved in the slave trade. Todd, wrote Garrison, had slaves shipped from Baltimore to New Orleans on his ship, the Francis. Todd, of course, filed countersuit, sued him for libel, and he filed suit in Maryland. The courts in Maryland were fairly sympathetic to slavery, even though slavery was, at this point, illegal in the North. And Garrison lost, was ordered to pay a fine of $50 in court costs. He could not pay that. He goes to prison for 6 months, and eventually an anti-slavery philanthropist named Arthur Tappan donated the money for his fine, so he gets out. He gets out. A couple years later, he starts another newspaper called The Liberator. The Liberator runs from basically 30 years before the Civil War begins until the Civil War ends, and he's writing for it the entire time, 1,800 issues. In its first issue, this is what Garrison writes, quote, "I am aware that many object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or to speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of the ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which he has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And in all caps, I will be heard. The apathy of the people is enough to make every statue leap from its pedestal and to hasten the resurrection of the dead. Garrison suffered many near threats to his near-death threats. 4 years after the Liberator was first printed, he was attacked by a mob in Boston, hogtied, and dragged through the streets by a rope. He was rescued by being lynched and spent the night in prison. This is in Boston. Slavery is illegal in Boston, but it still happened in Boston. The government of the state of Georgia offered a $5,000 reward for his arrest. On the eve of the Civil War, a Universalist preacher, in Brooklyn, New York, denounced the, quote, bloodthirsty sentiments of Garrison and his school, and we do not wonder that the feeling of the South was exasperated, taking as they did the insane and bloody ravings of Garrison as the opinions of all the North. Garrison, after the Civil War, writes his final editorial, and he retires from the Liberator, I think, like 6 months after the Civil War is closed. It's a pretty amazing story. 30 years of writing. 30 years. Harriet Beecher Stowe. We all know Harriet Beecher Stowe. She published Uncle Tom's Cabin first as a serial story in an abolitionist paper called The National Era. It was issued as a book in 1852, and the success of the book was unprecedented. 500,000 copies sold in the United States within the first 5 years. When Lincoln eventually met Harriet Beecher Stowe, he said to her, "So this is the little lady who started the war." 7 years after Stowe published Uncle Tom's Cabin in 1859, abolitionist by the name of John Brown leads a raid on Harper's Ferry. I'm just curious, how many of you have heard of John Brown? Okay. I'm from the South, and in the South, John Brown is this very, his reputation in the South is very peculiar. He's like perceived to be almost a saint. He's also perceived to be an absolute fanatic, and kind of in the same breath among the same people. Maybe that's your view of him, those of you who are familiar with him. A few years before he led the raid on Harper's Ferry while living in Kansas, Brown had ordered his followers to shoot 5 pro-slavery men in cold blood in retaliation for 5 free state settlers who earlier had been murdered. Brown perceived himself to be a martyr not just for a cause, slavery, but for a religious cause. His anti-slavery campaign was supported by very prominent northern clergy. Here's a little funny story. They apparently used to ship him rifles, but they would ship him rifles in boxes, and they marked the boxes Bibles. So the man who shipped him was the brother of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and so they used to call these rifles Beecher's Bibles. That's what they called them. In 1859, 2 years before the Civil War begins, John Brown leads a raid on Harper's Ferry, the site of the Federal Arsenal in northeastern Western Virginia. He and 20 followers are captured. They capture the arsenal. They hold it for a couple of days until Colonel Robert E. Lee recaptures the arsenal. Brown is taken prisoner, tried, and executed on counts of insurrection, murder, and treason. So these 3 abolitionists, combined with a couple of other events, make slavery in the United States impossible to ignore. Impossible to ignore. The other big event is that the West, and by the West we mean Kansas, the West is beginning to be settled. And so as frontiersmen are pushing West, the whole question of, well, if they form a state, is that state going to be free or is that going to be a slavery state, is increasingly a hot issue in the U.S. Legislature. So, first challenge, what do American Christians think about slavery? How do they react to slavery? 17 years before Garrison was dragged through Boston, the Presbyterian Church General Assembly unanimously adopted a manifesto declaring that the institution of slavery was, quote, utterly inconsistent with the law of God, end quote. But this same document, listen closely, also conceded that hasty emancipation was probably a greater curse than slavery. And furthermore, this is strange, the same Presbyterian General Assembly upholds a Lexington, Kentucky presbytery in keeping the Reverend George Byrne out of the ministry because he held anti-slavery views. So do you see, right from the get-go, I think this is kind of indicative of a lot of churches' approach to slavery. There's kind of an ambivalence. We don't like slavery. We condemn it. It's ungodly. But when push comes to shove, they kind of back off a little bit. They're not going to really want to push overly hard. You see this over and over until eventually the churches just begin to split, and they split north from south. It's very easy. The Baptists and Methodists, who used to early speak out against slavery in American history, in their words, quote, it was contrary to the laws of God, man, and nature, and hurtful to society, contrary to the dictates of conscience and pure religion, end quote. But they would later back off as more important members of the white community would join their churches. Surely at this time, most white people just wanted the issue to magically disappear. It would not disappear. Complicating matters is that so many slaves became Christians during the Second Great Awakening. So some slaves became Christians during the First Great Awakening, but many more became Christians during the Second Great Awakening. So this overturned this kind of strict hierarchy between slaves and slave owners. On rare occasions, the conversion of slaves led their owners to incredible responses. So there's a story about a slave named Mort. He is visited by an angel that tells him, this day you are made alive and freed from hell. Mort, who is on good terms with his master, this is somewhere in the South, forgive me, I don't have the exact state. Mort is on good terms with his master, and he tells his master about this vision of the angel that he has. Quote, my master sat watching and listening to me, and then he began to cry. He turned to me and said with a broken voice, Mort, I believe you are a preacher. From now on, you can preach to the people here on my place. But tomorrow, Sunday, I want you to preach to my family and to my neighbors. The next morning, says Mort, I stood up on two planks in front of the big house, and without my Bible or anything, I began to preach to my master and to the people. My thoughts came so fast I could hardly speak quick enough. My soul caught on fire, and I soon had them all in tears. I told them that they must be born again and that their souls must be free from the shackles of hell. This occurrence, as you might expect, was very rare. More often, slave owners might allow their slaves to attend preaching in churches of their own, but oftentimes in the South, they required that slaves attend white churches, and they would sit in, of course, like the white balcony or in the black balcony or the black bench. Many Southern slave owners did not want to have to face the potential ethical dilemmas of associated with owning a fellow brother in Christ. Furthermore, many Southern slave owners did not want to teach their slaves how to read the Bible, particularly the book of Exodus. And I have to just pause here. Do you remember first lecture, the Puritans went to King James I. They wanted a new translation in the English vernacular, and he gives it to them. But even King James is nervous about one book of the Bible, Exodus. He does not like the book of Exodus because the Israelites reject their monarchical, leader, the Pharaoh of Egypt. So it's just the tables have completely turned now. It's a sad, sad irony. Slavery was outlawed in the North beginning in 1787. Thus, the southern states were the only states permitted to own slaves. But historians agree that just because slavery was abolished in the North does not mean that the North was any less racist. It does not appear that it was. Even those who did not believe in slavery did not believe necessarily in racial equality. There's a story about a slave named Samuel Ringgold Ward. he and his parents escaped to New Jersey in 1812. He said of all the Northerners that he met, he found that the Quakers were most free of racism, but still, most of the Northerners retained sharp racist ideals. Ward said, quote, "When I went to the house of God, as it was called, I found all the Negro-hating usages and sentiments of general society there encouraged and embodied in the Negro pew, and in the disallowing the Negroes to commune until all the whites had finished. I knew more than one colored person driven to the total denial of all religion by the religious barbarism of the white New Yorkers and other northern champions of the slaveholder." The abolitionist movement continues to grow, and because the United States at the time is still overwhelmingly Protestant Christian, they use lots of Christian symbols and theology to push the abolitionist movement. Here are a few lines from a hymn written in 1844 by an abolitionist, saying that the nation is facing a moment. "This is a moment," says the hymn, "that we're either going to face the truth or we're going to turn our back on the truth. Once to every man and nation comes the moment to decide. In the strife of truth with falsehood for the good or evil side, though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis truth alone is strong, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own." Of course, to these arguments, Southern slave owners made religious arguments on their own behalf for slave owning. They quoted both from the New Testament and Old Testament verses that refer to slavery without condemning it. In particular, the book of Philemon, which is a letter from Paul asking a slave owner to take back a runaway slave. Southern slave owners argue that slavery was a kinder system than the pure labor system of the North. In the South, they argued, a slave is taken care of from cradle to grave. I mean, this is just... Okay. In fairness, the disparity of treatment of slaves in the South was wide. There were some absolutely horrible, grotesque conditions. There were other slave owners that, while owning slaves, treated them with great respect, dignity, et cetera, et cetera. So, given that, what I'm reading does not sound so implausible. But, anyway, they argue that a slave in the South is taken care of from cradle to grave, but in the North, a man isn't even given a job until he's already of working age, and when he's too old or injured in an industrial accident, he's thrown out. Okay, African slaves, what is their response to Christianity? We are racing along. We're going to make it. Before the Civil War, roughly 90% of all African Americans were slaves. The slave population was largely illiterate, and of course there was a reason why slave owners would like to keep them illiterate. Harry Hozier ended up being a black preacher who traveled with Francis Asbury. Francis Asbury was kind of the successor to John Wesley, the Methodist. Hozier was Asbury's kind of opening. He would preach and then Asbury would follow him. He was apparently very, very gifted as a preacher, full of emotional punch, and he could not read or write. Asbury offered repeatedly to teach him to read or write, but Hozier refused, saying that he was afraid that the gift of preaching would leave him if he became literate. What influence did the slaves' African heritage have on their religious lives, their view of Christianity? The effect of African tribal custom is probably seen most clearly in their approach to two things, music and baptism. So regarding music, one historian writes the following, quote, "Although first-generation slaves who were born and reared in the tribal culture remembered their native religion, the second and third generation of slaves born on the plantations had no such memories. For those slaves, Christianity was not grafted onto the living tree of African religion. Instead, those plantation-born African Americans incorporated into their Christianity certain beliefs and practices that paralleled those of their tribal cults and were passed down from their parents. For example, the love of baptism by immersion was evidenced by the slaves. Even blacks who joined the Methodist Church, Methodist churches tend to sprinkle, even blacks who joined the Methodist Church wanted to be immersed, and there is reason to believe that they were attracted to the immersion ceremonies of the Baptists because of the importance of following waters to the river cults of Africa. Singing styles also seem to have been imported from African tribal customs. The style of singing amongst slave was influenced by their African heritage. There's a strong a strong emphasis on call and response, polyrhythms, syncopation, ornamentation, slides from one note to another, and repetition. Other stylistic features included body movement, hand clapping, foot tapping, and heterophony. I don't know what heterophony means. I just think I know what it means. So if you press me on that, you're going to have to ask someone who's a little bit more knowledgeable. Do you know, Naomi, what it means?
No.
Just making other sounds? Okay. Okay. Heterophony means making other sounds, non-word sounds. Many of these distinctives couldn't be represented in Western musical notation, which explains why printed versions don't capture the peculiar flavor of slave songs, which were constantly labeled by white observers as wild, strangely fascinating, of peculiar quality, or barbaric. Because literacy rates were very low because of either bans or lack of access to education, African American theology thrived mainly through informal means and oral tradition. Those who could read the Bible strongly identified with the story of the Exodus. During the war, many slaves called Abraham Lincoln the second Moses. Skipping. Okay. The years before the Civil War. In the years before the Civil War, Christian churches began to schism over slavery. And as I said before, they tended to schism north from south. The issue that they were breaking over, clear and simple, was slavery. 1844, Methodists divide north from south. 1845, Baptists split north from south. 12 years later, Presbyterians split north from south. And then the war came in 1861. Both sides believed that they were fighting in a godly cause. Both would look at battlefield victories as signs of God's approval and enemies' defeats as signs of his chastisement. On the Union side, victories intensified feelings of righteousness. General Philip Brooks thanked God for the conquest of Richmond. Henry Ward Beecher condemned the Confederate leaders to an eternity in hell. The effects of the Civil War were absolutely devastating. So let me just recount some of the totals of deaths in previous wars, just so you can kind of get some scope. Total deaths in the Revolutionary War, total American deaths in the Revolutionary War, 25,000. World War I, 116,000. World War II, 405,000. Civil War, 625,000. As I said earlier, 8% of all white males between 13 and 43 died. 1 in 13 veterans of the Civil War were amputees. 1 in 13 veterans were amputees. Remember at this time that the United States is not a bubbling cauldron of religious pluralism. This is American Protestant Christians fighting American Protestant Christians largely. I read last week from Alexis de Tocqueville saying in 1843, Christianity in America reigns without obstacle by universal consent. Surely Abraham Lincoln, knowing this, had a very difficult task ahead of him when he stands forth for his second inaugural address. So Lincoln is elected briefly before the Civil War. Everyone is fearing that a civil war is going to happen. His whole first inaugural address is addressing, it's basically to the southern states saying, we are not going to fight you, you're going to start this war, but if you start this war, we're going to fight to keep the Union together. 4 years later, he's elected again, second inaugural address, it's very clear that the North is going to win, but now, and so Lincoln is looking forward to trying to keep the Union together, not just politically, but socially, culturally, religiously. The second inaugural address is one of my favorite things ever written by anyone. I get I get emotional every time I read it. So I'm going to read you segments of it. Just listen to how thoughtful Abraham, just think about what you would do if you're in this situation. You're the president of the United States. The North has fought the South over slavery. The North is going to win. Everyone in the United States is praying to the same God. Right? They're all praying to the same God. They have absolutely diametrically opposed convictions about slavery. What are you going to do in that situation? So I'm going to read some of Lincoln's address. A little bit of background. He delivered it on March 4th, 1865. There's a journalist there named Noah Brooks. And he something happens right when Lincoln steps forward to deliver the second inaugural address. This is what Brooks reports. A roar of applause shook the air, and again repeatedly, finally it died away on the outer fringes of the throng like a sweeping wave upon the shore. Just at that moment, the sun, which had been obscured all day, burst forth in its unclouded meridian splendor and flooded the spectacle with glory and with light. Brooks said Lincoln later told him, "Did you notice the sunburst? It made my heart jump." So everyone kind of, he's coming up to speak to everyone, and the sun kind of bursts through, and it's this, it's a very powerful moment. The London Spectator says of the second inaugural address, "We cannot read it without a renewed conviction that it is the noblest political document known to history, and should have for the nation and the statesmen he left behind him something of an almost sacred prophetic character." It's very short, but I'm just going to read a few snippets. 4 years ago, says Lincoln, all thoughts were anxiously directed to an impending civil war. All dreaded it. All sought to avert it. While the inaugural address was being delivered from this place, devoted altogether to saving the Union without war, insurgent agents were in the city seeking to destroy it, and the war came. Both sides of the war read the same Bible and pray to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. But the prayers of both could not be answered. That of neither has been answered fully. So Lincoln is now going to appeal to the providence of God to try to make sense of what has just happened in the United States. "The Almighty has his own purposes. If we shall suppose that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him?" The rhetorical answer is no. He then closes saying that even if the war continues, that God's will is still good. "Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue, so still it must be said that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity toward all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations." I will conclude there 6 minutes early.
Wow.
I know. I think I was in such haste to squeeze it all in that I probably cut too much. Any questions or comments? Next week, yes, question or comment.
So there was a lot of encouragement with Exodus and Philemon.
Exodus, yes. Philemon, no.
Philemon, no. Okay. Yeah. Exodus is kind of this funny book in one way because it has an emancipation from slavery in the beginning, but then in its sets of laws, once Israel's becoming a nation, it gives laws that inaugurate more slavery or that capitalize on more slavery. So was there an exegetical discussion really between the North and the South? that involved hermeneutics, how you understand right. Exodus and the slavery laws in the Torah.
When I look at the kind of debates that were happening before the Civil War, there were theological debates that happened, but both sides were already so entrenched that the subtleties of that sort of an exegesis, I think, would have just flown past everybody. Or they wouldn't have flown past everybody. I just don't think that people would have gotten deep enough into the exegesis of, let's say, Exodus, because it was full volume shouting, more or less from, gosh, 1820. That's an exaggeration. Maybe from, you know, mid-1830s until the Civil War began.
So the South, like, had their texts that they yelled across, and the North had their texts that they yelled across.
Yeah.
They just yelled Bible verses at each other.
Yeah. that didn't happen anymore, thankfully.
Just a comment. It seems fairly often in history classes now, the emphasis is on either political, like states' rights, or economic things that brought about the Civil War. And there is a tendency to say, oh, well, we used to always say it was slavery, but now we know better. Slavery was just one of many factors, and they go on. And it seems to me that the reason that this is the current take, I suppose, on the Civil War is because of the impulse to discount the religious convictions and loyalties that everybody had, pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they say, oh, slavery was an issue, they only look at it as a political or economic issue, and they'll tip their hat to it as a moral issue, but they don't think that's very important. And you pretty much, well, I won't say never, but you very rarely hear anything about the religious aspect of it.
Yeah.
I went to a Christian college in Kentucky, and I majored in history. And the man who taught the Civil War and Reconstruction class I took was a Christian. And he mentioned it. And he mentioned that you wouldn't hear it from anybody else.
He mentioned what? He mentioned
that the religious convictions about slavery was a lot bigger of a deal than you would hear elsewhere.
Yeah.
But he's the only person I heard it from, and I taught history, so I read a bunch of textbooks to get my notes and whatever. So it's just an interesting.
It's so hard to understand American. No, I think it's impossible to understand American history, especially up until the middle part of the 20th century. Absent an understanding of like what Christianity's influence in the United States is, I'm kind of consistently stunned by my own public school education. I had a public school education. It was a fine public school. And it was in the South, which is largely much more friendly to Christianity than, say, the North is or the Northwest is. But still, absolutely zero. There was just nothing. It's kind of a shame. No, it's a real shame. And I wish there was some way. I think there's something, we're kind of impoverished in public discourse because we don't quite know how to both talk about religious things. We don't know how to talk about religious things in a manner that does not deeply fear offending somebody. So we just cut out huge swaths of our own history because we don't know how to talk about things. It's kind of very disappointing. Questions or comments? Next week, it's going to start getting very spicy. Late part of the 1800s, we will not probably get into the 1900s, but where massive, massive changes hit the street in the United States. Namely, the Industrial Revolution hits the streets in the United States. And also, for the first time, the United States will experience something like a different religion coming to the shores, namely Irish Catholicism, because the potato famine is going to hit in Ireland, and droves of Irish Catholics are going to show up, and Protestants are not going to really know what to do. So next week it starts getting really interesting, and the week after that is fireworks. It'll get real exciting. To die for. TDF. Thank you, everybody. Yeah. Thanks.